This is In the Loop at the Half with Betty Lou.
Walmart shares are rising. The euro has been getting hammered this morning.
Midway through the trading day, where did we start? Where are we going to finish? It's In the Loop at the Half with Betty Lou.
Volatility is something that we've heard a lot about in terms of the equity market.
Non-stop coverage of the markets. In the Loop at the Half with Betty Lou starts right now on Bloomberg Radio.
Welcome to In the Loop at the Half. This is the place where we get you caught up on what's happened since the opening bell. And we look ahead to the closing bell. Thanks for joining me. I'm Betty Lou. Stocks are rebounding today. Yes, to a record, in fact, for the S&P from its biggest loss in a month yesterday after Russian President Vladimir Putin seemed to signal that the Ukraine crisis won't immediately escalate. He ordered his troops back to base. So it seems that for now, the macro concerns are a little bit on the back burner, which allows stocks to rally today. We have some big standouts in terms of movers. One of them is Radio Shack, one of the biggest losers today so far, down about 14%, had been off as much as 25% at one point. The company came out with their results, but what really grabbed the headlines was the announcement that they were going to close another 1,100 locations. That's about 20% of their footprint around the country. So we're going to dig deeper into Radio Shack in a moment. In many ways, people say, analysts have said that this represents sort of a declining business, buying your electronics, your hardware in a store, being killed by the online retail like Amazon. Okay, let's take a quick check on how the markets are trading. The Dow is up 204 points, so that's a gain of about 1.3%. The same for the S&P, rising to a record. 1870 is where the index is. The NASDAQ is also rallying, up 1.7%. In the bond markets, you've got yields spiking today, up 7 basis points to 2.67% for the 10-year yield. The dollar is slightly stronger given the rebound we're seeing in stocks. Oil prices are now down about 1.4%. Remember that oil actually spiked up yesterday on those tensions. And gold is lower by 1%. It had been rallying all yesterday based on investors fleeing to gold as a safe haven. We check the markets every 15 minutes throughout the trading day on Bloomberg Radio.
The In the Loop at the Half Drill Down.
The drill down, where we get down and dirty, drilling into a big story of the day. And Radio Shack is what we're focused on. Michael Pachter joining me, analyst with Wedbush Securities, covers Radio Shack. And as I'd mentioned to our listeners, slumping the most in 4 months. The fourth quarter sales trailed Wall Street estimates, closing as many as 1,100 locations. Michael, are you changing your rating on Radio Shack?
I couldn't tell you if I were going to, but I'm not seeing anything that changes my view. So I have a sell rating on the stock, and their results were worse than I expected, so that's consistent with my current rating. I'm still working on my model.
And your target is what for Radio Shack?
Currently $1, and that was based on an arbitrary value placed on just the going concern and the brand. And I would say the going concern has diminished value based on today's results. And the idea that they comped negative 19% tells you that the brand doesn't have a whole lot of equity with consumers.
Are we talking about a penny stock at this point?
I think today, shockingly, I think you're getting a little short squeeze. I think that the results are horrible, but I think some shorts are covering. The borrow on this thing is 50%, 50,
meaning
it costs you 50% annually to borrow the stock and sell it. My expectation is it drops another 50 cents to $1. As analyst notes come out, so I think it's going to approach my target. Under $1, I don't know. It'll take a while. The management team has plans to turn things around. Unfortunately, they don't have the cash to do so. I think that reorganizing the merchandise and restocking the stores with things people want is a great idea. But if you don't change the storefront or the name and you can't afford to advertise the fact that you're changing, then how are consumers going to figure that out? So I think these guys are 10 years too late. And again, this management team is competent. They're just new. And the old guys were incompetent and they're gone. It's not the current management
team's
fault.
But it might be too late to turn that ship.
10 years too late.
10 years too late. Mobile phones were weak. Mall traffic weak, as you had highlighted. So, if it's 10 years too late, what's the future in the next 12 months for Radio Shack?
You know, my honest opinion is they're gone. I think that, you know, my dollar target is based on somebody swooping in and buying the brand and perhaps taking some of the stores. But I don't think they can make it to Christmas. I think that at the rate that they're losing money, vendors are going to lose patience. If you listen to their call today, they said they have to consult with their creditors in order to get approval to close stores. They're certainly not consulting with investors. They've pretty much given up on investors. I think that these guys are now controlled by, you know, their creditors, and I think creditors are going to have trouble figuring out how they're going to get repaid on the outstanding debt. So I don't think they'll extend more debt. Mm-hmm. I think bankruptcy will wipe out the equity and will allow them to renegotiate with their landlords, and that could save them, but they need to do something to get out of their unfavorable leases.
Is there any model that Radio Shack could follow? Is there anybody else that kind of had followed this trajectory?
Circuit City followed this trajectory.
Companies
that aren't here anymore. The problem I think Radio Shack faces is that they always have been a convenience store,
yeah,
and they were a destination for things like batteries, you know, or flash memory, or things that most of us didn't know, you know, what it was or where to get it 10 or 15 years ago. But we all know now that that stuff's easily available on the internet. It's at, you know, those things are at drugstores. So, you know, when you bought lithium ion batteries 15 years ago, you weren't really sure what those flat, shiny things were. But go on to Amazon now and just type in the number on the back of the battery. There they are.
And
they're a lot cheaper. Yeah, they're a lot cheaper online.
All right, Michael, thank you for joining us. Appreciate it. Michael Pachter, analyst with Wedbush Securities. You heard it from him. Likely gone, Radio Shack gone by the end of this year.
Now, the In the Loop at the Half, Trader Radar.
Trader Radar, we bring the action on the trading floor to you. We find out what is on traders' minds. And today, on the Ring Center phone line is Keith Bliss, the Senior Vice President at Catone & Company. And Keith, what do you make of this seesaw that we've experienced in the markets? It sure tells me that traders are just, they're just, investors are just buying and selling on the news.
Well, they are. The secular bull market that we entered into probably 24 months ago is still very much intact. And I think this is one of the things that confuses people when we have these real drawdowns in the market like we saw at the end of January or like we saw yesterday. The internals of the market, when you look at advanced decline lines, when you look at technical indicators, when you look at individual sectors and industries not making lower lows, for example, but continuing on pretty much an upward path, that tells us that the health of the market is still there. So even if you have these short-term pullbacks, you saw it yesterday, there was no capitulation feel to the market in the price action. Mm. And the smart money just waited until they got to a level and they stepped back in. We've become conditioned to look at these geopolitical and global crises, and we always know that they're going to get resolved at the end of the day. So it presents a real buying opportunity, and that's what we're seeing in the action yesterday and today.
And of course, the question on investors' minds is how long is this going to last, though? Even if we are in are we going to see another correction? I mean, you know, given how much we fell just on speculation about Ukraine, you know, these markets seem pretty toppish here.
Well, they do, and as you pointed out, we're at another all-time high in the S&P 500, which is the index that I really concentrate on, and it's reasonable to think that. How much higher can we possibly go? I think at some point in 2014, you will start to see the market break down a little bit. It's going to depend upon economic data. We'll see more of that in March and April. Was it truly a weather event, or is the U.S. economy and global economy starting to weaken here, and how does that affect company earnings, and what is the proper valuation of the stock market based upon company earnings? My own opinion is that we should see some pullback. We've had quite a run in this market. When you take 2013 and what we've done at the beginning of this year, the S&P 500 is up now almost 33% in that short time frame, mm-hmm. including a 7.5% rally in the last month. So, yeah, I would be guarded here. I'd certainly keep some powder dry to go ahead and take advantage of a move up, but I'd certainly be rotating into some defensive sectors as we speak and take money off the table.
All right. Thank you so much, Keith. Always great to talk with you. Keith Bliss, the Senior Vice President at Catone & Company, on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange. And a quick check on the markets, the Dow up 208 points, the S&P rallying 1.3%, and the NASDAQ is up 1.7%. At the same time, you've got a sell-off going on in Treasuries. The bond yield, or the 10-year yield for the Treasury note, is up about 7 basis points, 2.67%. That is where the yield is trading. And oil prices taking a bit of a tumble, down 1.4%. Remember that it had risen quite strongly based on the tensions that we were seeing in Ukraine and Russia. We check the markets every 15 minutes throughout the trading day on Bloomberg Radio.
In the loop at the half callback.
Time now for the callback. The callback is when we bring back a topic from our earlier In the Loop television program, and we're bringing back a guest from our In the Loop television program, Christian Dumonet, the co-founder of Foodler. It's an online food delivery service that is in 48 cities across the United States, competing with some of the big guns like Grubhub, which, as you, if you were following the news, filed for an IPO on Friday to raise about $100 million. So, Christian, you know, 10 years ago, this was not a this was an uncharted territory. Let's put it that way. And now you've got more and more players like yours coming onto the scene. How are you going to compete with a company like Grubhub?
Right. Thanks for having me. Actually, we were started in 2004 as well, so we're used to well-funded competition.
There
right?
you go.
So yeah, it's it's great for the consumer. It's great for us. Keeps us moving forward. There's plenty of room for a handful of entrants.
Well, so explain, break it down for me, because why would a, and I asked you this earlier as well, but why would a customer choose Foodler over a brand that they may know a little bit better, like Grubhub?
Sure. So we're software engineers in our DNA. That's our background. So we are hyper focused on usability of the site and the apps. We are obsessed with metrics in terms of making the site as easy and as fast to use as possible.
Yes.
Along those lines, one of the things that we found trips people up is an abundance of choice. So in cities like New York or Boston, there are thousands of restaurants that deliver to just about any address. We have an algorithm that picks the best six based on your food preferences. Maybe you like avocados or seafood, or you're allergic to certain things.
Hmm.
We'll find you the best six restaurants for you, which saves you a lot of time.
So it's not just about location and type of cuisine. You're actually breaking it down even further into a...
Right. We look in individual food items. In fact, we have a patent on this where we analyze your orders for food concepts, types of food, individual dishes, ingredients, and so on. Also, cost preferences. Maybe you're cost sensitive or maybe you're not. Different consumers have different cost profiles. Things like that. There are about 20 factors going into it.
And tell me, how many restaurants do you have in your fold?
13,000.
13,000. And how many customers are you adding on?
Can't share exact numbers on how many we have, but we're growing what we believe to be faster than the competition, according to their public filing. We're really excited about our growth. In fact, our growth as a percentage has increased over the past few years. So,
But the whole space is growing. But, you've got a competitor, Grubhub, that's now about to raise about $100 million more. They're going to have a big war chest. I imagine that's got to be a little bit intimidating. What are you going to do about that? What are you going to do to compete with that?
Great. No, it's certainly out there, and they're a very strong competitor, of course. But as I said earlier, they've raised over $75 million to date. So another 100. Well, it's quite a bit more, but it's nothing new. And we see our users as being very loyal because of our loyalty program, the ease of use, the exclusive arrangements we have with restaurants, and the recommendations.
And what are you finding with the trends when people are ordering? What are the trends now?
Yeah, mobile's huge. We launched our iOS app about a year ago, and we see that people who go on from the site to use the app actually order 22% more. I think it's just less friction on the transaction. Basically, it's easier to grab your phone than to grab your laptop. We launched our Android app only 3 weeks ago, and the uptake there has actually been faster than on iOS a year ago.
Hmm.
So we're seeing huge growth in mobile, tablets as well. iPad is actually our best converting. When you look at the conversion rates that apply, iPad is the best of them all.
Oh, really? The iPad is okay. Well, I imagine it's a bigger screen, so you can kind of see a little bit better and get a better sense of the restaurants that you're ordering from. But what's your next iteration? What's the next iteration for you?
Yeah, I think it's a social idea. Food is a social activity, and to capitalize on that, to bring that to bear app-wise makes a lot of sense. In other words, rather than crowding around a computer screen or a phone, if we can make it super easy for your friends or your colleagues to join in on an order, share the check, et cetera, that'd be a great win.
And are you profitable yet?
Yes, we are.
You are? Okay. Mm-hmm. And how are you going to, I mean, aside from just adding on restaurants, but how are you going to continue to grow that profitability and expand your margins?
Right. Well, we've just hired Mike Vossler from Kayak to lead our mobile development. So we're bringing on technical talent. We'd like to attract technical talent. We see it as that's our big differentiator. Restaurants, better site, continued improvement on group ordering.
All right. Christian, mm-hmm. Thank you for joining us. Christian Dumonte, the co-founder of Foodler, a competitor to rival Grubhub. And a quick check, by the way, on stocks right now. As I mentioned, we're rebounding. The Dow up 216 points, S&P higher by 1.4%, and the NASDAQ rallying 1.7%.
It's High Noon on In the Loop at the Half.
High Noon is when we feature our big topic for the day. And Mike Jackson joining me, the CEO of AutoNation, the world's biggest, the largest auto dealer. Mike, you came out with some February 2014 sales data. Seems to spell continued good news. New vehicle sales increased up about 4%, the best since 2007. What's going on, Mike?
Betty Lou, good afternoon. Pleasure to join you. Yes, we retailed 22,000 new vehicles in the month of February. And of course, our strongest state was Florida, where it's been sunny and 75 degrees for the last 2 months. That was up 8%, but I got to say the rest of the country had a rough time with the weather. The industry was flat in February on the industry sales, and if I look at the previous 6 months, the industry has only increased their sales by 2% during the past 6 months, and the explanation being the government shutdown and now this horrific weather that most of the countries had for the past few months. And so inventories are high for the industry, and there is this expectation that we're going to have a very strong spring market.
Yeah.
But it hasn't happened yet. So we await it with great anticipation.
Well, what's going to what could make a difference in that? I mean, besides, obviously, better weather.
Well, the drivers of the overall recovery of the auto industry remain, which are that there's genuine replacement need from when people stopped buying cars in 08, 09, and 10.
And is there any left? Genuine need?
Yeah, I mean, the average age still sits out there at 11.3 years, a record all-time high for the vehicles in operation in the United States. We have great new products from the manufacturers, and we have the best financing available ever. So those are very strong, compelling drivers of the automotive recovery, and I expect industry sales to break through 16 million this year for the first time since back in 06, 07,
right,
something like that.
Since before the recession. But, okay, Mike, you made some news, though, in your release on another note where you said that you would consider selling Tesla, the Model S electric cars. Why'd you put that in there?
Well, I was asked the question earlier this morning about Tesla and the controversy in certain states about dealers fighting Tesla's distribution model, saying
right,
Tesla doesn't have the right to direct sell. My point of view is Tesla has the right to sell as they see fit, even in the great state of Texas, and I don't see it a threat to dealers' franchise model or a threat to AutoNation. And then I was asked the question, well, if you were ever offered to sell Tesla, would you? And I said, yes, I think it's an outstanding product, and I think it has from a product point of view, a role in the marketplace, and would be happy to sell it. But I think that...
Well, are you seeing anybody, are people demanding it? Are you seeing some demand?
Let me just finish. So I think that's years away, and that their direct model will serve them well at the low volumes they have today without that many vehicles on the road.
Mm-hmm.
But when they have greater service needs and greater volume needs, I think they'll transition to a
dealer
model.
Hmm. Have you heard at all from Tesla? Did you hear any word from them after those comments?
No, and I didn't expect any.
Right.
I mean, he's got a lot on his plate. Elon's in the process of building a 50 gigawatt factory out there. He has to decide which state is finally going to be in, as well as working on the development of the X and a volume model, and he's putting rocket ships up to the space station.
Let me ask you this.
So he's a busy guy.
He is a busy guy. He wears many hats. Are you skeptical? And I don't want to say still, because I don't quite know what your position is on the Model S or Tesla, but are you skeptical of this future growth and his promise of a mass market, cheaper electric car?
Well, this will be... I don't think anyone knows the answer to that question, including Mr. Musk. This volume electric car at the price point he's talking about is extremely difficult to do. I think that's if you look at the gigawatt factory he's talking about, he needs that to take out cost in the batteries, because
right.
the batteries are
exactly.
still horrendously expensive. And so, you know, it's a huge bet, a huge gamble. Nobody's ever done it before. He could be the one to pull it off.
Mike, you know, we were speaking with Dieter Zetsche, the chairman of Daimler and the head of Mercedes, and we asked him about driverless cars. You know, every single automaker out there is talking about automated cars and how that's the future. I mean, who's really going to be able to break the mold on that?
Well, automation is already migrating into the marketplace in many vehicles today at different levels. If you look at all the radars that are in cars today to control the automatic driving of cruise control, where basically acceleration and braking is done today. That's already autonomous capability that's in the car today.
Yeah.
And including that, if you're about to have an accident, the systems will take over and prevent you from having an accident. And then we already have lasers to keep you in your lane and mm-hmm. nudge you back in your lane. So that's taking over the steering. We already have self-parking. So many autonomous features are already in cars today. So it's not saying too much to say, you know, 5 to 10 years from now, you'll get in your car and say, home, and the car will drive you home. That's not unthinkable. And I think what it means...
It's not unthinkable, but isn't it transformative?
And it's transformative both from a convenience point of view and from a safety point of view.
Yes.
The number of accidents, injuries, and fatalities will drop dramatically. And I've been in, I don't want to say I drove, but I've been in the Google autonomous car out there in California, and I have to say, I'm passionate about driving, but going down to 101 in heavy traffic, it was a very relaxing way to go down the highway, and you're free to do other things.
Really?
Why the car is zipping along at 70 miles an hour, moving in and out of lanes in a very efficient way.
You were not worried at all, not scared at all?
Not in the slightest. It was a wonderful feeling. And so I think I fully agree with Dieter. And as I said, different levels of systems are already coming into the marketplace. And by the way, Betty Lou, it's interesting. The great debate or the critical path is most likely the legal route, not the technical route. How are we going to indemnify the manufacturers from the inevitable lawsuits when any accident happens for any reasons and the lawyers claim, your system should have kept that from happening?
Very good.
So, but anyway, it's on the way. It's very exciting, and I agree with you. It's absolutely transformational.
Mike, thank you for joining me. Mike Jackson, the CEO of AutoNation.
4 hours to go till the close. What are the four things you need to know?
We come to Four to Go, the four things you need to know as we head towards the close on this Tuesday. Libby Salaberry from Bloomberg First Word joining me. Libby, number four on your list is Dendrion.
Yes, Dendrion is down about 7% today. It's pairing some of yesterday's 15% gain after earnings. The company also announced that it plans to put its drug Provenge make it available in Europe. Now, this is a very volatile stock. The short interest is more than 20%. So shares were up 15% yesterday, probably boosted a little bit by some short covering. And then the shares were cut to market perform late yesterday at Bernstein, and they are now down today, pairing some of that gain.
All right. And Delta, number three?
Delta is up about 5% after reporting passenger revenue up 4% in the month of February. Now, this is in stark contrast to United, which had a lower PRASM report last week, sort of raising some concerns about the month of February for airlines, obviously with all the weather cancellations. Now, this shows that Delta was able to manage it despite 8,000 canceled flights in the month, and it's boosting shares today.
Lorillard is your number two stock.
Yeah, Lorillard is up for a second day. Yesterday it rose 9% and today up another 2% after, or as much as 6%, after a column in the FT speculated that Reynolds may have interest in buying the company. Now, a bunch of analysts came out right away yesterday afternoon saying this is a very unlikely deal, would have a huge risk from an antitrust perspective. But Wells Fargo said today that Reynolds could pay up to $80 a share for Lorillard, which when you compare that to the high 40s earlier this week, it's quite a contrast.
Okay. And a big manufacturing giant is your number one, Caterpillar.
Yes. Caterpillar is underperforming just slightly, only up about 0.5% in the market that's up today. And they have an analyst meeting after the close. Now, Caterpillar has been languishing a bit, suffering from huge cost cuts in CapEx in mining companies. So it'll be all eyes on their mining outlook when they present today after the close.
All right, Libby. Thank you so much. Libby Salaberry of Bloomberg First Word. Quick check on the markets. The Dow is, as I mentioned, rallying by over 200 points, up about 1.5%. The same for the S&P and the NASDAQ is in fact closing on a 2% gain at midday. Up next on Bloomberg Radio, the Hayes Advantage with Kathleen Hayes and Vonnie Quinn continues. I'm Betty Liu. This is In the Loop at the Half. And don't forget my new book, Work Smarts, what CEOs say you need to know to get ahead, available on Amazon. In the Loop at the Half, presented by Fordham University's Gabelli Center. Attend Fordham's comprehensive executive education program on value investing March 20th and 21st at Fordham's Rose Hill campus. Register today at fordhamgabellicenter.org.
You can listen to In the Loop at the Half with Betty Liu, weekdays at noon Eastern, in New York on Bloomberg 1130, in Boston on 1200 AM and 94.5 FM HD2, or on Sirius XM Satellite Radio Channel 119. Copyright 2014, Bloomberg LP.